Extension number 7310, roll number 2.
Colonel Cleve, tape 2. I wonder if you could continue with your description of the pillbox.
I think we got as far as the water system, and then there was an upper gallery, and on top of that there were two 6-inch Mark 7s, one of which was always used as the examination gun, because we were responsible for the examination service. They were always frightened that the Germans might come in with their fleet and bombard Portsmouth. So we had to be very careful about that. And frequently I had to be on... I was the officer of the watch, only a few weeks old. And it was enormous. We had enormous fun, because the officer of the watch was responsible for shooting the guns and everything. And how we did it was, we had one gun manned all the time. That was called the examination gun, and that had to be prepared to fire if a ship came in which didn't respond to the pass signal, whatever it was. And we were very naughty, because we had control of the searchlights, and normally they were doused and nobody could see anything. Then at surprise moments we had a lever and we had to switch open the covers, and suddenly the whole of the scene was lit up with searchlights, and we'd see a periscope of a submarine fire, and the gun is straight off this periscope. It was only a bit of flotsam or something like that, but we imagine it was absolutely wicked, but it was great fun. But on one occasion, I was on duty, and a ship, a small vessel, did come in and didn't respond to the pass sign, whatever the flag, whatever it was, and it was given two chances. It didn't respond, so I gave the order to fire. Of course, just in front of the vessel. Immediately, it stopped immediately. And later on, I was rung up by Horsehand, who were one of the other forts, and they were furious because they said one of my shell splinters had landed on the ship. I didn't care two hoots, I was doing my duty. So that was rather fun, and I loved that. And then I was responsible for training the men, and I learned a very great deal about how to adjust the gunnery of the guns because of the fall and rise in tide and all that sort of thing. The mathematics and the geometry of firing guns from coast defences, I think, could only be equaled or excelled by the problems which the Navy has with a rolling ship. Otherwise, it was full of gunnery problems of the very greatest interest.
The men you were training at this time, were those the men who eventually went to France with you?
What with?
The men you were training in gunnery.
No, they're quite different. They remained on the forts, although they were of course all regulars in those days, and when the siege batteries were gradually formed as the creation of new guns and houses was made, new batteries were formed out of any personnel they could get hold of. Our personnel came, some of it came from Ceylon and places like that, and we formed our battery, 36 siege battery, entirely from personnel from all over the country, different bits of Royal Gazan artillery from where they came.
And is the 36 siege battery, is that the battery you went to France with?
That's a battery that we mobilised with in Taunton at the end of September 1915 and went straight over to France with. And we were the first battery to arrive with guns any bigger than 6 inches. And caused a great deal of attention by the high authorities because of the sheer weight of the ammunition which these 8-inch howitzers could produce. But they were very improvised howitzers because they were old, I think 6-inch Mark 1s or something, cut in half. And the front half was thrown away, and the rest of it was bored out to 8 inches with rifling, and it was given. They were given modern breech mechanisms, and they were mounted on enormous tractor wheels, commercial tractor wheels like the steamrollers had that used to repair roads as they were available, and they were monstrous things and extremely heavy, but the machinery of the guns was very simple, and that's why they did so extremely well and didn't give nearly as much trouble as some of the more complicated guns that gradually came to appear later on.
I believe you had a special name for these 8-inch howitzers, didn't you?
Yes, because one of them we had was the very first one to be made, and it was marked 8-inch howitzer number 1, Mark 1. So we call that gun the original. And if it appears on photographs, which I think it does occasionally, as you'll see the original painted on it, and that was the first one to be made. And it fired marvellously accurately. And I think it was that helped us with our gunnery, which we specialised in, under our Major A.C.H. Dean, who was our battery commander, an ex-instructor in gunnery, who generally stayed in the battery position all through the Somme, while we subalterns had to go up in series and do forward observation officer for him. And the combination was perfect because the shooting was very accurate, and that's what gave us our fame and got him the DSO, but none of us anything else.
Could I ask you a little more about the howitzer gun? Am I right in thinking it fires upwards?
Yes, the howitzer fires upwards in a rather curved trajectory. So that when it arrives at the target, it drops rather from the sky, so to speak, instead of the flatter trajectory of a gun, which doesn't rise quite so much. And a gun, shall we say, is superb for shooting at a battleship, and a howitzer is superb for shooting at targets which are behind a hill, shall we say, or something like that. And a lot of the enemy batteries were behind hills, so howitzers were ideal for that purpose, and also for dropping down into trenches where there were minenwerfers and things like that, machine guns. A gun couldn't touch a machine gun, but we howitzers could.
I imagine that they were stationary. You would pull them into the position that was needed, because I was wondering what would happen when the mud started setting in, you know, how mobile these guns were with the tractors.
Yes, well, you raised a very, very important question, because they were awfully difficult to manoeuvre. That was the greatest advantage of them. They were unnecessarily heavy for their size, and you couldn't turn the gun round with a caterpillar, drawn by a caterpillar, in a road, and you really wanted the length of a tennis court to describe the circle. Then if you took a wrong road, which you did once or twice, and had to turn the guns round again, we had to leave the road and cross a field and probably got ditched in the process. So it was rather a business. And they had to have a wooden platform put down over the rather soft earth to strengthen the surface from which they had to fire. And then they had huge wooden chocks which we put behind the wheels. After the gun was laid, the final thing was to shove the shocks up as they were, huge chunks of wood, to jam the wheels, hoping that they wouldn't move. But they always did, of course, because they took half the recoil. Half the recoil was taken by the buffer and half by the movement of the gun, and the wheels used to ride right up to the top of the shocks, and then the curvature of the shocks made them go back forwards again by gravity. And if the drill was bad and the shocks weren't put in the quite the right position, the gun went back and got completely off the line and was slewed round. And one of our skills which we developed was purely due to the men, which were a splendid lot of Durham miners, and they used to get so good at placing the shocks that we could fire quite rapidly, knowing that the gun would recoil back into only a fraction of a degree off the line to the target. And it was larger. That also, I think, that got us our reputation for being so accurate.
How big a team would you have had with one howitzer?
I think the number was 10, of which I think four or six were the ammunition numbers, because feeding the guns with those very heavy shells was a real business, and getting the shells up into the gun position enough to fire rapidly was quite a problem. One was a layer, one was a breech mechanism, and the number one, the sergeant or NCO, was in charge of the detachment, and I can't remember what the fourth one was, but it was something like that. 10 to a detail, to a gun. Then behind that you had all the administrative people like cooks and transport drivers and so on.
Yes, I must ask you more about that when we come on to the battle of the Somme, because this is very interesting, I think. Before I ask you about the actual Battle of the Somme, you know, your battle experiences, could I go back now to your journey to France in 1915? It was 1915, wasn't it?
Yes.
Can you remember the dates?
The date was September the 28th, 1915.
Where did you set off
and
from?
We got all our equipment and during mobilisation at Taunton. Then we went by train. We had to load up all the guns and stores and lorries and transport and things ourselves at Taunton. And then we got to Southampton, and there we transferred the guns and transport were put, not by us, onto transport shipping, and we went by a river steamer, excursion steamer personnel to Boulogne. And then we had the next morning, we were encamped at the top of 2 miles beyond the harbour, at the top of a hill, a rest camp. And then we used to go down, we went down the next morning to help offload the guns. And after a few days, they were put onto a train, and we went up by train through Saint-Omer, which was just within range of the longest range German guns, and then later on to a terrible little village near Albert called La Houssoye, which the men call lousy because we were all billeted in the house where the fleas and bugs were simply appalling. And in the evening we could see, it's our first experience of battle, and we were frightfully intrigued when in the distance we saw the tracer bullets and heard the machine gun firing and all like that from the front line, with Elba in between us and the front line. And then we went into another infuriating thing. We were under a general who was Royal Field Artillery, horse-drawn, had no idea what to do with our howitzers, and he put us almost into the front line at a place called Collin Camp. And we had to do it, and we then had to find our observation posts near Hebuterne, and then lay the signal lines between the observation posts and the guns.
And you felt this strategy wasn't right, did you? That this you were well, given the wrong...
It was in the wrong place. For one thing, a howitzer can be positioned behind a ridge. We were right on top of a ridge there. They could see our flashes and everything. So stupid. And that was the kind of thing we suffered from mercilessly. Complete ignorance of the powers that be. And that's what put me against the staff. I got infuriated by the staff. Not always, but often by the terrible mistakes and bloomers they made in France. That was one of them.
Was there no consultation? You know, could you not turn round to this general? I don't know quite what his position was, I forget.
Well, but I couldn't because I was only a second lieutenant.
I see.
And all these generals and people who came round, we made no bones about telling them that we didn't like the position and all like that. And eventually we were moved from it and so on. But we did suffer a little bit of, quite a bit of shelling then, but had some frightfully amusing experiences into the bargain.
Can you remember any?
Yes. All subalterns were given motorbikes for transport, and they were marvellous triumph, 3.5 horsepowers, and they were commercial, and frightfully shiny with wonderful nickel-plated spokes and rims and all like that, and they'd listen like anything in the sun. They were marvellous. But they were jolly good machines, and they went extremely well. We became very fond of them, and we used to go all over the place, all over country and up the roads and things like that. And on one occasion, I was sent up to find an observation post for a very difficult shoot, which you couldn't see from anywhere that I could find. So eventually I parked the bike somewhere near Hebuterne and then thought, I couldn't see anybody about, and I thought, oh, well, that's all right. Now I'll go down that valley. And I walked down a valley because there was a ridge on the other side of it from which I thought I could see the target. And there was a gate and all that. I couldn't see a soul, not a soldier or a peasant or anybody. And I thought, that's not much use because I can't get any information. So I must go back and find somebody who knows more about it. So I went back to the place I started from to be arrested by a whole lot of soldiers, infantry, with their shiny bayonets and all like that pointing at me, because I was in oilskins, because we had a terrible rain, and they were marvellous. We were allowed to wear oilskins when we were on our motorbikes, and I must have looked a perfect sight. So I'm not surprised, and I had an awful job to explain that I wasn't a spy. They said, you are a spy. And I said, I wasn't a spy, and all like that. No good. And they were just going to march me off to their headquarters when I said, now look here, that's my motorbike over there, will you believe me if I can go off and ride it straight away? And with a little bit of demur, they said, yes. So I went off and I prayed like anything that it might go the first time. And I got onto the bike and with a mighty push kicked down the starting lever, and away it went, purring away the very first time, the engine. And so they said, "Now do you," I said to them, "Now do you believe me?" They said, "Oh yes, all right, off you go." And I got back.
Did you find there was quite a lot of confusion, though, because you didn't quite know who held what territory?
You're quite right, because it was in elementary days, and I don't think any barbed wire has been put up anywhere at that time. Perhaps only a little, but certainly not where we were. And there were trenches all over the place, and it was awfully difficult to tell which was the front line and which wasn't. So evidently I must have passed over the front line where it wasn't occupied, and thinking that it was further in front, and of course it wasn't. And the maps were very inadequate then, and so you couldn't be quite sure where you were.
When do you think it was that the battle lines became clearer? What sort of period?
Oh, I think well before the Somme broke out in 1915. I should say round about February or March. In 1915, by that time, there were excellent maps printed showing very clearly every trench in the neighbourhood of the map, German and British. And sometimes they were very short distance apart. On one occasion, I had to do a shoot from an observation post. I think it was only 60 yards away from the German front line. So it was very dangerous.
Yes, I understand their sniping was very good, wasn't it? The German sniping.
So the sniping was terribly accurate, and we had to be awfully careful. I remember on one occasion, would you like me to talk about this? I had to do FOO, forward observation officer, for a shoot on the German front line. And I couldn't see the thing from anywhere. And then eventually the infantry in the front line said, "We think if you go up into no man's land, just a little bit above them, beyond them, you'll see from there." And the front line is only about 100 yards away, the German front line. Fortunately, I found this place was littered, from my point of view, fortunately, was littered with unexploded 15-inch howitzer shells. That's another story. And they were lying on the surface of the ground, and I crawled up between two of them with a narrow slit in between from which I could see the German front line. And hardly blinking an eye, I looked through the slit and I saw a machine gun pointing straight at me. I knew it was a machine gun because the shiny muzzle was pointing directly at me, and I couldn't see anything behind it. So I was able to do the shoot. And I wasn't shot myself on that occasion.
You were saying about the unexploded howitzer shells, that was another story.
Mm. Well, the story briefly was this, that the Royal Marine Artillery, bless them because they're an excellent body of men, insisted on having their own weaponry, and they, I think, designed a 15-inch howitzer, which was the most abominable gun howitzer I have ever seen for design. It was atrocious, a huge monster, and it was the heaviest gun we then had, and it was mounted in three, I think, different sections, which all had to be put together on the site on a wooden platform, and it was such a small howitzer, it was only really in length, it was only really a mortar, and it had a very feeble charge, and hardly enough, it wasn't enough to keep the shell spinning. And on the Somme, we often used to see these 15 howitzer shells turning topsy-turvy like that over in the air, And, of course, if they didn't land on the fuse and landed on their side, they didn't go off. And there were hundreds and hundreds of them lying on the surface of the of no man's land. To our advantage as observers, but not to anyone else's.
Why was that? What were the disadvantages?
The advantages were they gave us cover.
Yes.
Because you had to crawl from shell hole to shell hole.
Yes.
And if you found you were in a shell hole and you couldn't quite see, and there were a couple of shells like there were on that occasion, on the surface of the ground, I could just put my head up in between the slit and was protected from being shot at.
Yes, like your previous experience. But you said also there were advantages of having these, disadvantages of having these unexploded shells. Did this mean that sometimes they would go up?
No, I didn't mean that. I meant disadvantage in the sense that they'd been wasted. They hadn't done what they were intended to do.
Yes. Oh, I see. What action were you involved with before the Somme started in 1916? I think it was the 1st of July, wasn't it? 1916. What were you doing up until then?
Well, it was a very maddening period for us because we'd hardly got settled down in one position when we moved to another. And I'd never yet been able to make up my mind whether it was because it was simple muddling by the staff, which I think it may have been, that it often was, or whether, in fact, it was deliberate in that we, being an experienced battery, we were moved from one position to another in order to dig dugouts and gun floors and like that sort of thing and lay platforms. And then we'd hardly finished that when we moved to another. Hardly any firing, then we moved to another one. And we must have done, my diary will tell, I'm not sure, probably about 8 or 9 different moves, different positions in a very short time, which was quite a thing for a massive thing. Cumbersome thing like the 8-inch houses, not for the field guns. And that was what we spent most of our time doing, and shooting quite a lot from each position before we moved to another one.